O mighty one, our sacrifice begins. We commence.
To Spellbird, a podcast about the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. It's time to party like it's 1974.
We're approaching DCC number 100, and we're also approaching Spellburn 100. What better way to celebrate an anniversary than to reflect on some great stuff over the past 8, 9, 10 years? So I want to do a series of episodes on classic and maybe even also new and unsung, but still classic adventures. And there's obviously no better place to start than Sailors on the Starless Sea. We'll find out if it was the first or second funnel adventure with the world's foremost authority on sailors and on many more DCC adventures. I'm Judge Julian, and with me this evening are Judge Jeff.
Hello.
And Judge Jen.
Grammar is important.
And almost ready to celebrate his 29th birthday tomorrow, Judge Harley.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for having me back on. Woo! This is a real treat. Woo-hoo!
We were just saying that Harley may be the Steve Martin of Spellburn. This is what, number four, five-ish?
Seven. I don't know. We got to get more t-shirts made up, apparently.
The fans keep loving it, and the ratings are going through the roof even right now. So thank you for being back, Harley.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Well, you are welcome. Yeah, and you're literally welcome anytime, and hopefully fairly soon again. But for now, we're going to head on over to the tavern.
Welcome, friends. Good to see you.
I only had one drink to calm my nerves.
Innkeeper, a drink of your most expensive.
Tavern talk.
All right, here we are in the tavern, and first things first, I am going to plug a con for a cause. This one comes to us from Mark Palmer over in the UK, and it's concerning AlbaCon, which is an online tabletop RPG convention which raises money for It's Good to Give. That's the name of the organization, which is a charity which provides support to young cancer patients and their families in the form of stays at their amazing Ripple Retreat. And there's a link there that I'll put in the show notes. But Mark has a personal link with the organization after they provided support when his son was diagnosed with leukemia. And there is a happy ending to this story. After 3 years, his kid is doing great. He's recovered and even better yet, is a keen gamer. So AlbaCon is taking judge submissions now, and they have a strong DCC representation, including three games run by Judge Daniel Joseph Bishop. It's run by a team in Scotland, the con that is, and it's an international convention. It's online, and there are going to be game slots to suit everybody's time zone. There'll also be seminars, workshops, live streams, and plenty of God only knows what. Maybe I'll even do some stuff to annoy people. So I'll put the con link in there as well. It is AlbaCon, albacon.co.uk, and Twitter at AlbaconRPG.
And it's going to be held the 3rd and 4th of October this year.
Yes, thank you so much, Jen. I somehow totally neglected to put that in the show notes. But thank you for keeping me honest, because you do want to know that. So go ahead and take a look, sign up, run some stuff, play some stuff. And
I feel mostly confident this episode will be edited and put out before October 3rd.
I'm feeling awesome. Good about it,
but one never knows.
Jeff, what do you have to recount in the tavern? By the way, I'm going to go last. I just, that was a public service announcement, but then I'm going to yammer on at the end.
Great.
Okie doke. So it has been 8 days since we recorded our last episode of Spellburn. And in that time, I know, right? It's crazy. Normally we have longer, like 2 or 3 weeks, but this time is only 8 days. But because of hashtag quarantine life, I have had three games in the last 8 days. We finished up our last session of Mothership with Sean Kelly from Gaming and BS on the Gaming and BS Twitch stream. That was a ton of fun. Ogda, my transcendental meditating space marine, is now lost forever upon the dead planet. So good stuff all around. And also, we had another session of my old school essentials, BX stripped down, freeform silliness that takes place in the Wilderlands. And it's just kind of a big hex crawl with a bunch of adventures thrown in. And currently my my players are running through a section of the Egg of the Phoenix module.
Oh, nice.
And it's one of the original TSR, yeah. And we also had a session of Blades Against Bandwidth with Brendan LaSalle and Jarrett Crater. Our buddy Jarrett was the special guest. Nice. And Jarrett, who is playing the special guest character sheet, burned the wizard down to basically nothing and spent all of that character's luck. So when we've got Diogo on this Sunday, he's going to be handed a wet, limp wizard.
Dude, that is foul. don't play Diogo like that. Come on.
Hey, I didn't do it.
It had to be somebody.
Okay.
So that's what I have to report this week.
Jen, how about you?
We've had another, 8 days? I don't remember if I was two games in yet to the War Crawl with Mike Curtis or just one, but we've completed game number 3. Team Law is now third level going into the next game. And that's kind of exciting because I've never actually played a third level cleric before.
Nice.
So like, ooh, there's all this new stuff. There's spells I've never even really looked at. So that's actually been pretty foremost in my brain lately. We also finished up the Shadow Mountains funnel with Andy Markham. And I have one character that's kind of left, but she's got a strength of 5 and an agility of 4. And I'm not sure how long she's going to last in this world.
So she's a warrior?
No, probably witchcraft, shed folk magic wizard. And then prepping for the Founders and Legends, I think it's the third annual version of Founders and Legends. And that will be taking place, I think, July 18th and 19th, if I'm correct on that, I hope.
Yeah.
I was like, it's either the 17th or the 18th. That one is put on by Luke Gygax and co. And he actually posted in the DCC group of, I missed you guys in the spring for GaryCon. Could we get some DCC going up in here? So I'll probably bring something to the table for that. But I think signups, registration for games will start, a week prior. Not sure when this is going to end up airing.
Cool.
That's all for me.
Harley, how about you? Have you been able to roll some dice lately?
Yeah, so I'm running weekly games for my library group. It's a bunch of teenagers that are, we used to be in the library, now we're meeting online, playing via Roll20. We have, we've reached that part of the DCC campaign where all the adventures are entirely character-driven by like what patrons they've angered and what demons they've pissed off. And so we have a fifth level halfling with 12 hit points who has decided she's going to dethrone orcs. And and a former demon. She has no shortage of ambition, but her in real life, her brother is being played by a former demon. So Arok is a former
Direct that, reverse it. Yeah.
Exactly. You got it. Flip it. And anyhow, and so, you know, he once upon a time served as Modius, and then he tried to do the whole Justicia thing, and that didn't work out. And so now he's decided to make himself. He's going to try to attempt to be a paladin of his own creation. He's going to worship himself and derive divine power from that. And like, everything's just like spilling out from there, right? Like, at this point, I don't write adventures anymore. I don't create anything for them. They just interact with each other and like the five or four factions that are in play in the world, and like everything generates itself. So yeah, so that's my weekly
Amazing.
Game. And Love I know it won't be in time for this, but we'd be remiss to not mention that Purple Sorcerer is doing their annual pledge drive July 9th to 12th. So if you guys find yourselves on Twitters or Facebooks, you know, shout that out for, you know, Purple Sorcerer's annual fun drive.
Yeah. Yeah, we should. I'll put it on the MeWe thing for sure. Thank you. That's a good reminder.
That'd be awesome. Thank you.
Do you have any cool swag in the pot for the pledge stuff this year?
Yeah. You know, so I'm all I have that's really cool that I can share are just like the maps I make. But it was so
awesome.
Well, no, I mean the maps are kind of lame, but it was Cyclops when one of the players came in and he had won the Purple Sorcerer Seven Pits of Cezarkon maps. And so he had, like, you know, the Cezarkon poster and the postcard, the maps. He had them all framed. It was so cool. It was like, it was really neat. So yeah, I'll be sending those. I have more maps to send off to John Marr, and
wow,
yeah, be excited to get them into folks' hands.
I did that and pledged a couple of years ago, 3 years ago or something. I don't know when. And I got some Michael Curtis swag. I got like the manuscript and maps or copies of the maps or something for Making of the Ghost Ring.
Oh, nice.
And I remember looking at it. Oh yeah, it was cool. But I remember looking at it and going, this guy's a freaking engineer. Like, this is like not okay. Like, I'm just completely, I feel like everything that I've turned in is like in crayon, and you know, everything is just very neat and orderly and single spaced and just kind of, and I'm just like, wow, I'm a slob. So it was a little bit like, holy smoke, but it was still really pretty fun. And it's really cool to get that stuff and be able to go through there and just see how these guys work. So, and we're going to hopefully delve into some of that tonight. So cool. So yeah, we first I want to say also RIP Jim Holloway, right? I guess he passed away last week. So that's a big loss. And what, I mean, I don't know how many, he may not have done that many pieces for DCC, although he's got a lot in the core book. Mm-hmm. But of course, the funnel guys with the skeleton is one of the sort of
iconic,
seminal,
yeah.
Yeah. And then
the pitchfork on the spine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the chicken, the wizard or the fighter with the chicken head, you know, transformed in the magic section, is that's a total classic too. So they had a nice little write up on the Goodman Games site, but he's kind of an unsung artist, but gosh, he did a ton of stuff. I love his chill stuff back from the 80s too. And that's a big loss.
I don't know if you guys remember from the Road Crew days back in 2013, if you ran 9 games, Goodman sent you a piece of original art from the core book. And as it turns out, there's a few of us on Facebook that are going, oh my gosh, I finally dug it out. Like, so there's no mark, you know, no artist mark, no autograph, no nothing. Whose piece would this be? And two of us got answers of, oh, you guys got original Jeff Hollerin's. Like, whoa.
That's wow. Amazing. Right on.
Wow.
So back in 13, they were doing,
Yeah.
Class act.
That's pretty cool. All right. Well, I ran a couple sessions of City of the Damned, and very relevant because Andre, who has sent us some letters today, we had sort of a Neo finale Sunday, and it was it was a really kind of epic battle, including a little PvP at the end, sort of, and a little cross faction action. And it was pretty, we had fireworks and smoke and blood prices to be paid and all that good stuff. So, that was pretty fun. So it's fun to get to Andre's emails after all this time. I'll just say that. And with that, Jeff, do you want to reach in there and grab this one that you've been waiting for with bated breath?
Yeah, I will go ahead and read this one with my dukes up. my knuckles are white as I hold this parchment.
Wait. Having said that, do we need to wait for the bumper right here?
Oh yeah.
I was wondering.
Oh no.
I'm like, Jeff's just gonna make some magic.
Here it comes.
I call upon the flame to summon you.
Who'll deliver the message for me?
I came here to give you these facts.
Summon email.
There we go.
And Judge Andre has an email for us. Greeting, judges of the char-grilled spell. In matters of real-world language, there is such a thing as an objective answer. Gesh, Gaius, Geese is a real Irish word. And while there are several dialects of Irish, none of them would pronounce it geese, nor would they turn it into two definite syllables like Gaius. If it is spelled G-E-A-S, it roughly rhymes with face. The more correct spelling, G-E-I-S, sounds the same, but like a drunk Irishman is saying it. Julian's gesh comes closest. Geish would be closer. Of course, old habits die hard, but judges who refuse to break these habits die harder. Now, this Tome of Wisdom has been opened. Any judge who continues to mispronounce it must roll 1d10 on the table below. Well, I am happy to roll 1d10 on the table below. Wait. Because I am going to continue pronouncing it geese. And here's why. So, Judge Andre says G-E-I-S is a real Irish word. You are correct, it is. And I brought up Paris before, which is a real French word that's pronounced Paris. Also, I did a little bit of digging when I saw this was the word of the, was our email for today. And chocolate is a Spanish word pronounced chocolate. So if we are going to stick specifically with how those words are pronounced in the language in which they come from, you are all saying chocolate wrong. And unless you say chocolate, you also need to roll on this D10 table. Also, in America, or at least not, I mean, in American English, which is from England, we say privacy. We don't say privacy. We say schedule. We don't say schedule. We say vitamin. We don't say vitamin. We don't say aluminium. So unless you're going to start saying privacy, schedule, vitamin, and aluminium, then you also need to roll on this D10 table. So yes, I will continue saying geese, vitamin, and chocolate, and I will roll on this table below. Thank you, Judge Andre.
Can I go on a different rant?
But should we read my result first?
I thought this was DCC. Why is it a damn D10?
I know, right? Oh. Yeah. This... Judge Andre, I'm sorry. You need to resubmit this as a D11 table. But in the meantime, I have rolled a 9.
Oh, boy.
So what happens to me?
All right.
You are under a geese.
Somebody have to roll again?
Who it is that you are... to see who it is you are compelled to viciously and painfully murder. And I rolled a 2, so it is the judge to your right. Mm-hmm. And in my screen, the judge to my right is actually Judge Jen. So I am sorry, Judge Jen. I am compelled to murder you. So the next time we meet, we will have to draw blades.
I'm okay with that. That makes perfect sense.
Does anybody else feel that they need to roll on this table, or are you all going to start saying choco latte and privacy?
I've always said choco latte. I don't know what you're.
Yeah.
Hello, then, Jeff. Should we schedule our next session, our next episode?
I don't know. I have privacy concerns with all these online webcam programs. But what did you roll, Jen?
I have a four.
A four. Do you want to read this one?
Are you going to make me read it? Because I will actually pronounce it correctly.
Oh, yeah.
Then yes, please.
The great Irish hero, Cuchulainn, who died because of a geish laid upon him, takes offense at your lighthearted treatment of his plight. Now semi-deified, Cuchulainn appears on his phantom chariot with his gut spear in hand. He challenges you to single combat and attacks immediately. Cuchulainn fights as a sixth-level warrior with the added ability to use divine aid to call upon his father, the god of heroes. Wicked... We're allowed one of these without getting into the non-family-friendly, right?
Yes.
Wicked fucking metal plays while he fights. He looks forward to adding your head to his chariot. And, in parentheses... note, if you mispronounce his name, roll again on this table and suffer an additional result if you live.
Well, good news. Unless somebody wants to argue with your pronunciation of that name, you get to stick with just this.
I mean, I could also fight about Skaya versus Cathach, but, it's Spanish, or Scottish versus Welsh versus Irish. I mean, seven nations of this... Yeah. Anyhow.
Julian.
Oh, I'm good. I'm all over the geish. I can just kind of meld my geish to geish, and I'm feeling real solid.
Now, Harley, how do you pronounce C-H-O-C-O-L-A-T-E?
I have no dog in this fight, but I'm rolling anyhow. All
right. Go with the Cuchulainn.
No.
Charlie's like, what are these lunatics talking about?
All right. My mouth has grown fond of mispronouncing words. It does so more and more every day. After 8 days, I can speak nothing but incomprehensible gibberish, no matter how hard I try. I'm convinced it's not my fault. It's my lips. And if I can just get rid of them, preferably by sawing them off with a spoon, I'm certain I'll be all right, which is not far from the truth. So there we go.
And I believe the word is gibberish.
Dude.
All right, maybe we can move on to another email.
Yeah. Oh, hey, look at that. It's Andre again.
Hey.
Hello, great and mighty judges. And also Julian. I'm a big fan of clerics in DCC. I love everything about them, but I especially like the idea that offering sacrifices buys points with one's patron. Julian can attest that my cat priest is currently investing considerable resources in building an altar for Bast. For future campaigns, I'm also curious about how human sacrifice, or demi-human sacrifice, might work. I'm somewhat newer to DCC, so forgive me if this is covered already, but what are your favorite write-ups of cleric patrons who accept or even demand sacrifice of intelligent beings? Do these kinds of sacrifices count as more than a normal offering of gold or jewels, or work differently in any way? Or perhaps more fun, if you were going to make human sacrifice rules for a deity, how would you make it work? And he signs... definitely not plotting anything, Andre. Hey, let's throw it to our guest.
So, all right, I'm imagining running this for my my sixth and seventh graders, right? And the first thing they would do is like they would go to the nearest town and round up every peasant and like, all right, Harley, I'm going to sacrifice these 50 peasants. I'd be like, oh, that's boring and lame. So I think if you're going to no, but seriously, it's like, okay, yeah, you could push a bunch of peasants into the flaming pit atop the ziggurat, but what's cool about that, right? So I think you have to go like, if you're going to use it in a game, like go back to the roots, like go back to like Beastmaster, right? Like, you know, man born not of woman, like those are the sort of people you can sacrifice. You have to like sacrifice the seventh son of the seventh son. You have to find, you know, a woman born under, you know, the North Star, you know, like it has to be like cool, iconic stuff to sacrifice. Like maybe the evil high priests, they keep like the populace in check by tossing random people into the volcano. But if a PC is going to, you know, earn the wheel of his, you know, wicked deity, it has to be like, they have to be cool sacrifices. They have to be something that's like significant. I want that priest, like, you know, riding through town, searching down, you know, the infant that the mother is hidden, you know, somewhere, you know, in the forest with the druids or something. It has to be like cool. It just can't be like a boring sacrifice. Yeah. And that's what my kids would do.
Love it.
Like, seventh graders would like run out there and their mother would overhear them playing and they're like, yes. And we grab the infant and hurl it into the ziggurat. And I'm like, oh, man. Anyways, that's where I go.
That was fun while it lasted, right?
or conversely, don't let them do 50 peasants, but rather like make them do one at a time and just get some tables and be like, oh, this is old man Chalmers and he's got a wooden leg and he limps up the ziggurat and, you know, and pulls on his, okay, fine, just do it. You know, and you're at this point, your right arm is getting tired. You know, you're getting your minus two from a cramp. Let's see if you can make it a clean cut, you know, and just see if they can last through a whole session of actually slaughtering 50. That would be a good...
Well, that's dark. I love it.
Well, you know. I will say that Dying Earth has some related mechanics for the witch class. I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about this stuff. Anyway, I've run plenty of Dying Earth games at plenty of cons, and people know about the rules a little bit here and there. So, there's a witch class, and the witch class has a ritual sacrifice thing that powers Spellburn. So there.
Very cool.
And also a transfer vitality thing that can actually move life force from and one unfortunate to a bon vivant of their choosing.
Do you have to play poor unfortunate souls when that happens?
Would be best, but now keep in mind those rules are, you know, kind of in flux and anything could change, but you know.
Fair. The first thing that I thought of, and this is why I didn't answer right away, is I had to open it up. I can't think of any specific examples that's already been written out for DCC, but I immediately thought of White Dwarf Magazine issue number 35 with the Necromancer character class. And that Necromancer character class has minimum sacrifices required to the demon that you're getting your powers from. So the frequency with which you need to make your sacrifices becomes more and more frequent the more and more powerful you get, and the kind of sacrifice you need to make becomes more and more intense. So I think that would be kind of a fun thing to steal from it. Now, granted, if we're sticking directly with this chart, I mean, right away, like you can at first level, you're sacrificing dogs, cats, horses, things like that, and by higher levels, you need to be sacrificing like human virgins and things like that. But I definitely love Harley's idea of this like roll on a couple of different charts to build up what the sacrifice that's demanded this time is. I think maybe like a blank blank who blanks chart would be really cool. Like you need like the a blind mother who hasn't seen the sun in 30 days. Something like that would be a really cool, fun chart to work with to find your sacrifices.
For that, I would also turn to The Lesser Key to the Celestial Legion by Don Stroud.
Are there sacrifices in that? I don't remember that.
Yes. Yes. Ooh, there are all sorts of stuffs in there. So, yeah, especially for a cleric, this is the book you need. So, yeah, that's my
and, two cents. And if you really want to go dark, there's Carcosa, but I'm sure I'll regret saying that at some point soon.
Carcosa's got some cool stuff in there, though.
Yeah. Oh, I love
that. There's some very questionable stuff, but also some very cool stuff.
Very cool stuff. So, that's what we got for you, Andre. So this has been the Andre episode of Spellburn. Thanks, everybody, Harley, for stopping by. And no, wait, no, it's not
great
about
to hang
Andre.
Out with Andre.
Sorry. Yeah, it was good to hang out. It always is good to. I've been gaming with Andre for about 10 to 12 years and started with Castles and Crusades a long time ago. And we've had a blast gaming together. So, yeah, it's fun to have him in there with Big Matt Tull from Mississippi and John Carnes and Trevor and the guys here. We're having a great campaign there. So it's a lot of fun. All right. Ready for the main event. I think we're ready to talk with Harley about sailors.
Let the combat begin! To the death!
Why, behold, our hero.
Huh. So you want to play rough, eh? We'll take this!
Mighty Deeds.
Woohoo! All right, here we are in Mighty Deeds, and you knew that we were going to do this, being the Snowflakes literary... I don't know. What's the literary equivalent of social justice? I am going to just say there are spoilers ahead in case you're one of like the six DCC people who've never played Sailors on the Starless Sea. There are spoilers ahead. So don't email us and say, I didn't understand that you were going to talk about the specific traps in the adventure or the specific encounters, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about. So if you haven't played it and you want to preserve that, and then don't listen to the rest of this episode, please. That's all.
The one thing to know is as soon as you see tentacles, dive in the water and start stabbing.
Always investigate plant life. Always.
And this goes for every adventure. Just go down the well. What could go wrong?
And if the room looks really cold, it's not. It's an illusion. Just walk right in there. You'll be fine.
All right, now we're leaving and going into the spoiler zone. All right, well, thanks for being here with us, Harley. And Sailors on the Starless Sea, it's been quite a while. I think it's, about 8 years old now, officially from publication?
From 2012? Publication, yeah. This is actually really cool. Like, you guys had me digging. I went back in my emails and I submitted it to Joseph on August 12th of 2010.
Wow.
Oh, you wrote it almost exactly. Oh, you were probably working on it 10 years ago today.
Yeah.
Oh, well, my God.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm kidding. And you were just crazy. 19 then, which is amazing. So one of the things that came up when I was thinking about this, one of the first questions I had scratching my head was, I keep saying it's the first funnel, but of course Portal Under the Stars came out in the book, and I don't even know which of those was published first, or were they basically published exactly at the same time, but obviously, or maybe, I mean, maybe it's lost in the mists of time, but like, which one is the first funnel, do you think?
Well, I think you're right that they're both published at the same time, but I'm certain that Portal was released first. Actually, probably as like a free RPG Day, like teaser release, ahead of the actual release of the core book.
Oh, it's in the beta. 11?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I ran it. I ran it with the beta rules for sure in 2011, I think.
Yeah.
So Sailors didn't come out until the official publication.
Right, exactly.
And I know that Sailors is number 67 and Doom of the Savage Kings is 66.5, but didn't Sailors come out before Doom of the Savage Kings? Isn't it the first standalone, or do I have that wrong?
No, you're right. Sailors came out first, and I was writing, I wrote Doom of the Savage Kings later, when the whole thing started to pick up speed. That's when Joseph came back. He's like, hey, can you write something else? And that was Doom of the Savage Kings that got included in like the burger glue in the back of the rule book, or like the second, yeah, like inside.
That's right.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, because we got that the same time that we got the core book. Yeah,
you're right. Yep.
Wow.
Okay. So
wow, but Sailors really was the first one that you wrote.
Oh, absolutely.
RPG,
like. Doug and I were working on that way before we started anything else. Yeah. And way before we knew that, you know, like DCC RPG would be around or anything. Like, we had no clue, right? We were coming off of the wreckage of 4E, or at least what it had done to like publishers and distributors. And, you know, we had you know, Joseph had this idea and we had no clue whether or not it gained any traction.
So that's what I was going to ask. Like, how did it interact with the development of DCC itself? Like the actual rules itself, like were you kind of writing this adventure and then the rules are being developed in parallel, or did you have kind of a springboard to, you know, start working with? And obviously they kept developing as you were going.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so like to give context, right? So August 12th is when I submit Sailors, and then, but like May 3rd of that same year is when we first get Joseph's rules for like lay on hands. Right. And like, and you're talking about Holloway, right? So like May 6th was when Holloway submitted his chicken spell fumble art. I had emailed Joseph in July asking him like, are we DMs? Are we GMs? And it was like in July that he was like, no, we're judges. Like this is more old school. So like a month before I'm submitting Sailors, we're still deciding on, you know, what we're going to call the guy, person running the game. And then like in August, you know, Joseph's referring me to mutable magic and telling me that wizards forget spells if they fail on the casting, but they can keep casting if they don't. You know, so like all of that. So it was like like a massive chunk of the manuscript is done, you know, courtesy of, you know, Joseph. And it's all still like, you know, evolving towards, you know, and has a ways to go to come towards, you know, what we know as DCC RPG today.
I am so happy that you've gone through these old emails. Like, what a treasure trove. Cool.
I would like print them out for you and like send you PDFs of them all. Like, you know, like it was amazing. Like I was just like tabbing through them all this afternoon. Cause I had no idea, like, did I write that? Was the core book out? Did I know what I was doing? You know, but like, this is like, and forgive me, like I could go on all like September 27th, I'm emailing Joseph, like, how do you use luck again? You know, it was all wide open, but that's the beauty of a funnel, right? Because you don't need any
fangirl moment,
you know, yeah. You can just,
right.
You
know, right.
They have 1d4 hit points and it's modified by the stats, whatever those stats are. And then it's just go time. So it was a very easy adventure to write in a lot of ways because we had no rules at the moment, or very few rules.
Yeah. So you had done some 4E adventures, and of course Goodman had a whole not a billion of them, but like, I don't know, 10 or something, right? Uh-huh, uh-huh. So like,
yeah, like something like Cell Swords of Punjar, maybe, was that what
yeah
it was called?
Yeah, some yeah of that stuff.
Yeah, we had done like
so Harley, four, how yeah how what kind of transition was that to be? I mean, 4E was not a, you know, a glamorous success. Okay. So for the whole industry. Right. So, I mean, how did you guys arrive at, you know, we're putting that away. We're going to do something totally different. And then now I've got a clean slate and I've got to write an adventure and it's a zero level. Like what the, I mean, how did you even approach that as a kind of mind experiment?
You know, like my attempts at writing 4E adventures were pretty flawed because at that point, so at the very end of 3.5, Doug and myself and some other folks were starting to go back to like the Appendix N authors that we loved, and we had like intentionally moved out of just like imitating old TSR adventures at that point. And we're like trying to do something a little bit different. And so if you look back at all my 4E Punjar adventures, you know, they're all Fafford and Gray Mouser, you know, just with, you know, with the serial numbers like scrubbed off. And so like we were attempting to shoehorn 4E around, you know, Appendix N. And failing miserably. like they were horrible. Like the adventures were awesome. Yeah. The adventures are awesome. But if you look at them and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to move this 5-foot step here and my power, you know, forces this target to move, you know, 15 steps or 15 feet towards me. It's like the maps don't work. You know, it was not good, but we were already like that impulse of like, no, this is the stuff we like. This is the stuff we want to write about was already in there at the end of 3.5 and all through 4E. And so when you know, after the hiatus, and you know, and we're waiting for like distributors to pay Joseph again, and game stores to come back up. Oh, you know, after that hiatus, you know, and Joseph comes back, he's like, "I have this great idea. You know, this is what we're going to write. This is what we're going to do." And that was, you know, that was, we were writing DCC RPG just because it was what we had been wanting to write for so long.
Hmm. Did you? So great. So that's the context. And then where did Sailors come from? You just, did he say, I want to, you know, where did it, like, did you come up with this funnel thing, or did he say, there's going to be a funnel? No, it's going to be zero levels. Harley, go. Or, you know,
he's like, you know, will you write the introductory adventure? I don't even know if we had a sense of what a funnel was yet necessarily at that point. Well, that's not entirely true, because like Joseph's, you know, you look at, you know, his pre betas, and it's like, you know, you know, the gods of luck matter, your PC will die, you know, he gives these, you know, like 10 principles that all of the adventures will be written around. And so but we were given, you know, this really wide open space to write something that we were interested in, and not knowing whether or not it would actually, you know, see publication or be popular or do anything, you know, we had the time and the space to pour all of our, you know, all of our RPG love and lore into this one space, thinking that, you know, nothing would ever come of it. You know, it was like, you know, this opportunity to just you got one chance, you're going to go for it. And it's like, okay, yeah, sure. Sweet. So, you know, I love Errol Otis's, you know, like side drawn castle from the basic book. So let's do something like that. And so, you know, we could draw from all these disparate, you know, sources to make this adventure that we loved, and, you know, without any concept that it would amount to anything.
Wow. Yeah. That must've been quite a time. How long did you work on it around, do you think?
Oh God, I'm sure it was way too long.
You were saying like,
it must have been at least 3 months.
But
oh God, Jen, you have no idea, right? Like, and I went up, so, you know, paging through those emails from Joseph back in 2010, I found at least one like begging for an extension on Sailors. yeah, but you know, but it's not a long adventure. You know, it's all fairly short. But I don't know. Yeah.
So putting into some of the details of Sailors, like Beastmen, was that a conscious choice? Julian has a really great note in here. You know, it could have just as easily been orcs or goblins or kobolds or something. So was that an editorial choice, or was that yours?
Well, you know, so part of the, you know, the edicts handed down from Joseph, you know, just from the start, was that, you know, we're not going to call anything an orc. We're not going to call anything a goblin. And by this point, you know, just like you guys, you know, I've been, you know, been gaming for, you know, 30 odd years, and we're all just sick of the introductory adventure where there's 15 kobolds that knock over a merchant train and you have to track the kobolds down. And like, it was like, this is so boring. If we're going to write one adventure for a fantasy heartbreaker that'll never see publication, let's make it like super sweet. Right. So let's just go big. And, you know, and at that same time, you know, I'm paging through old, like, you know, RuneQuest stuff, and then just the Beastmen were just so cool. Like, so, all right. When I grew up, I was, you know, in rural Colorado, we drove 45 minutes to get to a sewing shop where they sold miniatures. That was the only place that I could get like game material. So, wow. You know, I got my dragon or I got my dungeon, and just flipping through the back, there's just this world of role-playing games that I would never have the opportunity to see. Like all this crazy UK stuff and riffs and whatever, like, you know, 1984, whatever craziness is in the back of a Dragon magazine, and bigger than what it was actually like being presented is like what a 12-year-old is thinking is being presented, you know, like, cause your mind builds it up so much bigger than it actually is. Right. You're like, oh my God, this is amazing. And if I ever had the money to buy it, I probably would have been, you know, disappointed, but I didn't. And so we all have this you know, this the potential is greater, and that potential is never ruined because I could never find any material. So yeah, so it was just it was drawing from all these different sources that I've loved for as long as I've been gaming.
You talk in the sixth printing thing where they did the big anniversary deal in this thing here. I'm showing it on the video, but of course you can't see it on the podcast. Beautiful. But you know, I've got this. I know. It's pretty. I mean, I'm not just shamelessly shilling.
The end sheets are my favorite.
For Joseph here, but it is pretty friggin' sweet. The end sheets are great, and there's a bunch of extra different artists' take on the cover in the back, which is also really fun. And then there's a cool little interview with Harley, and I'm assuming it's Joseph or somebody, but I'm not sure 100%. But also has your maps, Harley, which your original maps, I guess. And they're pretty sweet, actually. I think they look great. Again, I'm ashamed of. I feel again like I'm just working in crayon here. But these were Doug's first like DCC style Kovaxian maps, were they?
Yeah.
I guess Portal Under the Stars is too. But right.
But we hadn't seen that. We hadn't seen that layout yet. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so,
so what was it like the first time you get the image or the.
Well, so I had fallen in love with Goodman Games when they're still doing like the blue lined maps, you know, like you'd see in Keep on the Borderlands, like outlining the Caves of Chaos. Like I had opened the Sunless Garden from Brendan LaSalle, and I saw those blue lined maps there, and I was like, oh my God, these are so cool. And then through all like 3.5 and all of 4E, like, you know, Doug wasn't doing any of the maps. And so we all had cartographers, and I had it wedged in my head that, you know, the mission of a map is to deliver the cartographical information as cleanly and as instantly as possible. So the judge can like flip it open, look at it and immediately apprehend, oh, this is area 4A. Here's a secret door. It's all very clear because it's this blue, you know, S and there's a line through it. And then Doug, he turns back this thing, and I rue the day. You know, I wish I could say that I opened the email and I fell in love and I you know, screamed Doug's praise to the heavens. But to my regret, to my eternal regret, I did not. I looked at that and I was like, what the hell? You can't read it. It's obscured. Maybe there's a keep here. Maybe there's not. So you know, to my great regret, you know, like I didn't appreciate, and I say this without blowing Doug up, but like I didn't appreciate, you know, what was being delivered then. And it took me a while to like really sink into, like, no, this is a map that like a. You could blow it up into a poster, you know, like 3 feet by 4 feet, and hang it on the wall and, you know, when you're a 12-year-old in the bedroom and just stare at it for hours, imagining all the adventures that are going to take place there. And, you know, and seeing the monsters and seeing the tone of the adventure and seeing like the gesture of what's going to happen to your player characters, and just dreaming about, oh, you know, because you can almost see on Doug's maps, right? Like, well, that step is crumbling and maybe somebody's going to fall down that step. And there's just so much more information being delivered, but it really rewards the viewer in a way that requires an interactive viewer. You can't be passive. You have to have an active engagement.
I found it really helpful as somebody who had never run before. I'd never picked up a book and run an adventure. I'd only been the player. Uh-huh. So any maps that I saw were usually just whatever somebody scribbled down on the table. Uh-huh. And seeing those maps and being able to first run those games, I didn't even have to read the text to get what he was coming from.
But you didn't have the mental baggage of the previous 20 years.
But now anytime I want to try to recreate a map of his, yeah, I'm cursing his name every damn time.
Well, and you know, and it's just the artistry that, you know, you can see the time that Doug had and the love that he had to pour into that map. Because, you know, the maps of Sailors are just amazing. And And it's you know, without like shilling myself, it's the only time that I've seen maps, you know, approaching that is when the work that he did on DCC 100, and they're just as chaotic and just like the same, like black ink swarm of chaos coming at your face with more information than your brain can process at once. And it's really exciting.
That's very cool. Yeah. I mean, I obviously it's pretty much everybody's like first experience of playing DCC is like, or running DCC anyway, is like trying to deal with these maps and being like, what the, you've never seen it. And then imagine if it was the color version too, because that six printing has a colorized version, which is also totally psychedelic. And anyway, yeah, I mean, that obviously a big deal. I noticed right away, and I've noticed this in a lot of DCC adventures. So, and I don't know, you know, where you were in your thinking in the Sailor's days, because obviously that was a long time ago, and what you think since then. But I really liked, that there were two ways into the main, you know, complex, right? So that even that is the PCs have a lot of different ways if they choose to explore and go around and not take the obvious route there, you know, there's different things. They can have a pretty different adventure, right? Because if you go up the ambush or the, what do you call it? The avalanche and uncover that tomb, you can have a pretty different adventure than if you just go in through the vine whipping guys. And I kind of took that with me in my own thinking about adventures for DCC is, you know, make them as, you know, I mean, to some degree, you know, especially in shorter things, they're going to be a little bit linear. But even then, you want to have, you know, more than one way to connect things and more than one way into things. So, you know, is that part of your thinking in DCC generally, or was it just this adventure, or even pre-DCC?
You know, I think one of the cool things about DCC is that the players have so many options if they're willing to get creative, you know, and they'll take any first level spell. And, you know, it's like, we undid your entire adventure with our creative use of read magic. And so...
Yeah.
You know, like there's the like just the very last game I ran, one of the players, you know, he was, you know, giving me sass on the side. He's like, that's what I love about DCC is like, you can either try to solve the puzzle or not, you know, and we'll just man up and go through it the hard way. And, you know, they used force manipulation in some weird way.
Yeah.
To get
it's going to be a fun game.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I think, you know, I think for me it's like a balance, right? Because I'm a sucker for set piece encounters. Like, I want, if you're gonna play Sailors, I want you to run into the tentacles. Like, you know, the Leviathan like has to come to pass. At the same time, you know, you want to provide some opportunities for meaningful differentiation if the PC is coming at it a different way, or like, you know, they cast some spell that completely transforms the, you know, the first few encounters. So I think it's balancing between the two, because you want a cool set piece encounter that that's going to be memorable to players, and at the same time you want to give them space to meaningfully transform the adventure to their advantage.
So and I read it, so I reread it, and I was thinking, and I remembered that there's the whole, the avalanche trap thing as you come over those stones. But then I said, you know, I've run this thing at least four times and nobody's ever even thought of going around the keep to look, like not even traverse around the keep entirely. They right? haven't even looked around the corners on either left nor right.
And
right.
So, yeah, very rarely do they encounter anything cold.
Yeah.
And honestly, I was surprised that tomb is there when I reread it. I was like, this is so fucking cool. And I was like reading it for the first time practically.
If you ran it for a bunch of 11-year-olds who have never played RPGs before, they would find it. They would circumnavigate the thing. They would poke at it from 100 weird ways. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Cause I feel like almost every time I've run it, I've had people unearth it.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
Huh.
So Harley, I have a question about cross-game compatibility with Sailors on the Starless Sea. Because, for example, I have run old-school games in Dungeon Crawl Classics with great success. I had a ton of fun running Teagle Manor as an adventure with DCC characters. I'm curious how successful you think Sailors on the Starless Sea would be in the opposite of that. What if somebody who is playing an old school Essentials game wanted to have their like BX characters walk into Sailors on the Starless Sea?
My very first impulse is that before I even get a chance to think about it, is that it would eat them alive, but I don't know why. Like, why are a bunch of zero level characters with 2 hit points or less? I think when you walk into an adventure with like a dwarf with, you know, like 6 hit points, you think about problems differently than when you are a gong farmer with 1 hit point. I think by virtue of other games giving their starting characters more power, I think that handicaps them when it comes to something like Sailors. So yeah, whatever. It could be run fine, but it would probably be like, for a BX game, it'd probably be like a second level adventure, or like you know, first to third level adventure. So you have a third level fighter and a second level, you know, magic user. But there's something about like DCC players, they get, and not because they're smarter inherently, but they play smarter when they have just 1 hit point and they know like everything's going to be over here, you know, because if I get hit by anything. And so all of a sudden, like, you know, like, you know, like the warrior, you know, or, you know, whatever, the squire with the sword, he knows that like if he gets into a situation where he has to swing a sword at something, he's lost already, right? Like whatever ability he had to tilt the encounter into his favor, by the time he's rolling initiative, like game over. Like at that point, it's all on the roll of the dice. But when he's going into something with 1 hit point, he's like, okay, well, we're going to pour oil down these steps and sucker these guys back up here. And once they get to the top, the steps are covered in oil. Then we throw flames on them, and then we trigger the avalanche on top of them. You know, like players are forced to be smarter because they have so much fewer resources, if that makes any sense. And I think in other games, you know, you're tricked into too often. And that's not universally true, but too often you're tricked into just, you know, using your character sheet.
But imagine the first level through third level characters all sitting on the raft over the Leviathan. And instead of having 15 characters left and sacrificing a zero, there's 5 guys on the raft looking at each other like,
right? Then it matters.
None of them want in. You don't want
in? They don't have any chickens to sacrifice. All of a sudden, right. It's real. Who are we voting off the raft?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I have a question for you, Harley. I know that a lot of the modules have in their reprint stage, Joseph's made sure that there's additional content included with all of them. Is that kind of how the Summoning Pit came about, or shall we just say the expanded area,
right,
I believe?
You know,
How did that come about?
It was one of the reprints, and Joseph's, I was like, Harley, is there anything you need to change? And not because I think it's good, but just because I think if I touch it, I'll screw it up more. I'm like, no, we don't need anything. We don't need to change anything, just because, you know, however fortunate I got the first time, I'll just make it worse by like screwing with it, you know, more often. But then to my great regret, I realized, you know, there's the vine horrors in the very start of the adventure. Everyone who's ever played is going to lose a PC to a fumble, you know, a character on character fumble against the vine horrors. And I was like, these don't exist anywhere else in the adventure. And I was like, oh, I'm just stupid. Like because I wrote it just going forward, like, oh, here's a cool thing. And then here's the next cool thing. And here's the next cool thing. And so, you know, the summoning pits were an effort to justify and place and kind of give a context and a reference for the vine horrors. That's how that came about.
And on a personal note, that was an awesome little addition because I was able to tack it on somewhere else within the campaign. And the few players that were there at the very beginning went, oh, hell no, I remember these. So beautiful.
That's awesome.
That is a really, That is, it's a really creepy, it's a short little, you know, like 2 or 3 page thing, but there, it's extremely bizarre, kind of psychedelic, I would say, especially that last encounter is really fun and nutty, you know? So yeah, if you, if you haven't read that anyway, that's a lot of fun.
Your party could TPK before you even get to the water.
Yeah. Freaking dangerous too. Yeah, for sure.
So if you could go and if you were going to rewrite Sailors on the Starless Sea, knowing what you know now, would there be any major changes?
Again, I don't think I would touch it again, like, you know, because I'll just make it worse. However, if I would hesitate for anyone to use Sailors as a model because there's way, way, way too much magic for like an introductory DCC adventure. Unless like you're like, you're gonna like, all right, we're gonna seed these items and these are the only magic items you're gonna get for the next 4 levels. So I think it's a
thank poor you for funnel. Addressing that.
it's a poor funnel in that regard. Like it you know, it you look at it and you can easily see like the influence of like 3.5 or 4E and just that, you know, yeah, you know, there's an encounter and if there's going to be a pool, there's gotta be something awesome at the base of the pool, you know, and that's just AD&D right there. Like you cannot have a pool and not something in it. So, but again, I not because I think I got it right, but I think Sailors is right for what it is. I wouldn't change anything.
Yeah. Julian, yeah. How do you feel about the fact that there are DC 17 luck checks in Sailors on the Starless Sea?
Oh, that is the one.
Well, you're going to have to roll.
Yeah. Sorry. Go.
See?
I'm pretty sure there's like a strength check in there. Change. A strength Absolutely. Check to open a door or somewhere or lift something. That's just lame. That is lame. That should be changed. Jen should redline that. And it's like, no, it either takes 5 minutes or you can do it in one action if you hit, you know, strength check X. But, yeah. Anyhow. But
you make a bunch of noise in the Beastmen.
Exactly. But a good judge is going to interpret all that and save me from my poor writing.
I was going to ask Harley, how ballpark, how many times do you think you've run this, and how many, you know, percent roughly of those have been TPKs, do you think?
You know, my problem is anytime everybody dies, I'm going to introduce new players or new PCs. Sorry. Anytime all the players die, I'm going to find new players. Even when we go through scores and dozens of PCs, it's never going to be a TPK. I have, you know, in the hardback,
there's still a villager that could be rescued.
Oh yeah, yeah. Or they stumble down there, and anytime you know, it's so easy to roll up a new character. So I don't know that I've ever had a true TPK running Sailors, which is not true of everybody. I hear horror stories about like. It turns off like some gamers, a lot of gamers. I hear, you know, I cringe inside whenever I hear, well, yeah, we ran Sailors 3 times and we TPK'd 3 times and my players wanted to do something else. It's like, oh man, like that stinks. And at the same time, like maybe you don't attack the Leviathan every time thinking like, well, if I just roll a 20, you know, it's going to die. Like, yeah, because you know it is. There is that concept of like, well, you know, not everything's, you know, establishes. You know, not everything's level appropriate, and you can't kill everything. And killing stuff isn't the way to get through it. Like it's like the original Murder Hobo adventure, but killing is not the solution to every challenge.
Yeah, I had a party early on that attacked and drove off or killed the Leviathan just because they refused to not attack the thing, and obviously didn't go very. I can't remember if they TPK'd. I think they didn't, but they ended up rolling up to the pyramid with, you know, 3 characters left or something. You know, like it's not gonna. But to your point, Harley, the last time I ran it. Which I really enjoyed, this weird little method. It was almost more like what you're describing. I just had a big stack of like 50 zeros, and these guys had never mostly played any DCC or funnels before, but I just handed them one character, and when they died, I just handed them a new one, and I just kept handing them.
Yep.
They were only playing one at a time, but yep. I was just handing them one at a time. And then it is more or less, so they never ran out, right? But it's a totally different cast of like whatever, six or eight by the time they get to the end. The first time I ran it, the guys of course got to the end and got the big, fetish, whatever, the big thing with the god on it, and they got it, and they kind of nearly won their two or three battered and bruised guys, and they won the thing from the priest at the top, and they like, I raise it over my head and give a triumphant yell, and then I cast the fetish down into the lava. Right, so nice. They triggered the god to come up, and
that is brilliant. That is so fun. That is awesome. So,
yeah. You can't do it better than players do it.
Yeah. One of the brand new players to my table said, but there's all of these villagers being herded up. So once he got to the top of the ziggurat, he turns around and gives this great rallying speech. Like this huge inspirational thing, and rolled a nat 20.
Nice. So,
okay, yeah, you know, the villagers turn, they revolt, they start trying to push the beastmen off, and
yeah. Oh, that's heaven right there,
yeah,
right?
Players.
Like, when they pull that mm-hmm. off, it's just
exactly.
Like, oh, that's when, like, you know, like, and everything's dead, right? It's just like, you're like, this
it's
is
the
all
moment
this...
you talk about,
yes,
yeah,
exactly. Like, none of the, you know, like, Doug's illustrations, my poor writing, you know, it's all just like ink and wood pulp. But when you take it to the table and like players like come up with really cool solutions and then it's backed up with a nat 20, like that's magical. Like you live for those moments. That's heaven. That's so cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what I really want to know is when you're on the ship and it bursts forth from the cavern wall, where does that ship really go?
I don't have any answer, Jim. I love you.
What's the official
the
answer,
official
Harley?
Official answer.
Where does the ship go?
Into adventure. right? But like, what is the encounter? Like, I think I said like into the unknown. And so it's referencing like BX and just, you know, all that nonsense.
Is there any chance that it's like a reverse Dungeons and Dragons cartoon introduction?
Oh, how cool would that be?
You end up coming out and it's like you're in Splash Mountain in like 1982 Disney World.
Oh my god. And the barbarian hops out and starts hacking at the guy who's like, give me your ticket. Yeah, that's sweet. You should write that. That's brilliant. That's what we do. That's okay. So this is okay because at some point Joseph's gonna print this again. But we should have like a dozen different endings to where it spits you out, right? And like we get all like what
tables.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I was gonna say have 14 and you roll a D14 to see which ending you get.
That'd be so cool. All right, you guys win. That's Jeff. Jeff, you get to write one. That's so
all
cool.
Right.
That's so cool. Where does it take you? I love it.
Yeah, Jeff, it'll be Murder on the Starless Sea ride.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, gee, Harley, since it's been a decade since you wrote this thing, what's your favorite part about it?
I think my favorite encounter is you know when the avalanche is triggered and they get down into the tomb, and they encounter like whatever the four dooms, and you know either like ice skate across the room or like they try to figure some different way to get through there. I think that's. Oh, although, like the whole like encounter area E, you know, like the tar monster, and you know, and it like you know, it's barred off from the outside. That always freaks players out. Like they never go in there for no good
That's
reason.
That's my favorite room.
Yeah, like for no good reason. Like there's nothing in there.
No, there's plenty of good reason.
But what's fun, though, is I find that the way characters respond to at least the way that I present that room, I don't know. But like, I get a completely different reaction every single time. And people are trying to interact with the room in a completely different way each time. And you're right. Like, they're completely freaked out by that room.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably pretty fun. That was not intentional and just a blast.
The pool with the skulls.
Mm. Oh, nice. Right on.
So I had players picking those up and taking them with them to further adventures.
Nice.
And so they have this detection thing going on.
I have to pick the Leviathan, although just to backtrack, I say the next time I run it, I'm starting them on the crumbled walls and making them to do the avalanche. I'm just going to not even... You know, I'm starting them there and letting them climb the rocks and then going in that way because I'd never done that. But I got to pick the Leviathan as my all-time favorite bit. But I loved what you said in that interview in the sixth printing, or it was in How to Write Adventure. I can't remember, Harley, but you said the Leviathan is a puzzle that is a monster, right? It's not a spinning dial with a bunch of numbers that you have to piece out a word to it or figure out how to match the primary colors or whatever. It's actually just it's an actual puzzle that occurs naturally in a dungeon right? environment.
Yeah, like it's a puzzle disguised as a combat, which is like our lives, right? Like, so, you know, like we're faced with puzzles every day and they don't look like chessboards. And so, which is just cool. So you present your PCs with something impossible to defeat by normal means, and they have to like think their way around it.
Yeah. And yep.
Did you ever run or play in the DugCon version, the reverse sailors?
No, I got to watch him run it once at the you know the bar at Gen Con. But I've never played in it myself. But it was beautiful. You know, it was just, you know, Doug running, you know, Chaos Warriors and, you know, Marines and you know, and the Beastmen are struggling to survive and they're grabbing their bolters and firing them off at the Space Marines and, you know, it's just you know.
It was out there.
It was have any of you guys had a chance to play?
Reverse, no.
No. I would love to.
The very first Gen Con where I met you guys, like 13, I think. Yeah, that was my introduction to Doug Con. I was a little confused.
Thanks for sticking it out. That's awesome. Yeah.
But it also allowed me to recruit one of my other friends into it. And all of a sudden he's like, well, hey, this was actually kind of cool. And I'm like, this wasn't even DCC.
I don't understand. Yeah.
No, it was the most DCC, Jen.
Right. I get that now.
Well, but, you know, but like, it can't be overstated enough how crucial artwork is to an adventure. Like, as important, if not more important than the written word, you know, we've been going through like Temple of Elemental Evil for the 5e reprint, and I'm going to forget the name, but if you look at any of the art for T2 through 4, you know, the actual Temple of Elemental Evil, a lot of them is like the art assigned Fred J, even though it's like Parkinson or Easley. And while the adventure is so cool, the artwork in the second half is just like crushingly just, you look at it and it's all like, oh, here's another door, here's another corridor. Hmm. You know, and these brilliant artists, Easley, Parkinson, Elmore, you know, they're signing these things as Fred because they don't want to claim credit for artwork that they don't think is good. And so and then you look at no, true. Like find your what? Temple of Elemental Evil, flip to the second half, and you're gonna see everything signed by Fred. And it's like, this is a brilliant adventure. And the artists aren't in love with the work they're producing. And I don't know the backstory. I don't know why. I don't know, maybe they're rushed. You know, Gary Gygax says, like, we have to have this by the end of the week. Like, you know, spit me out a corridor. But it's when adventures have this lush, evocative artwork that the artists love, and then it just grabs your brain in a different way than than just text and artwork that's so-so. And so, I don't know. We're so fortunate to have. I mean, let's even reframe it, right? This is just an art book supported by text that Harley got to write to. Like, you know, it's that level of artwork is that important. And the art being, you know, you guys could flip open to, you know, map one in Sims right now and see something brand new for the first time. There's like that.
Yeah, but I also feel like you're being too humble and you're deflecting your own writing too much.
No.
Hold on. Because there is some fucking, I'm sorry. So we've already used two of them today. Brilliant stuff in here. Like, for example, this has nothing to do. I mean, Doug is an incredible artist. Yes, absolutely. Yes, and you are also awesome. Like, looking at this Beastman mutation table, I love this Beastman mutation table. Doug Kovacs had nothing to do with this Beastman mutation table. This was all out of your twisted little brain, Harley. And unless I don't know, did somebody else, did Doug write that?
No.
Okay. No. Yeah, so that's all you.
Wait, I have it on authority that Doug wrote most of DCC and most of Sailor Man.
He told us how to write. He told us what to read before we wrote it.
Exactly. Yeah. So with that in mind, if it's okay with you guys, I would love to showcase this table by giving us each a Beastman mutation real quick.
Oh, very nice.
All right, hit it up.
All right.
Let's do it.
So Jen, you have oversized hanging gels that dripped black ichor and tiny pinholes for eyes.
Oh, nice of you to notice.
And Julian, you're looking great today with your face devoid of mandible form, leaving a flapping wet mess in place of a mouth and nose.
No, all right, thank
Speaking
you.
Speaking of crayon.
All right, thank you.
That's a repeat. And Harley, you're looking great with your receding lips that curl back to reveal a saber-like fangs and slit pupils of a cat. And today, I feel like I'm looking very stunning with another reroll because I keep getting the same things.
Just pick one.
And I'm looking beautiful with my iridescent scales and the head of a lizard.
Nice.
Now, on behalf of Andre, shouldn't this table be a D14, not a D12? Isn't a D12 a little mundane?
Not at the beginning of DCC, because D12 was still really neglected.
Yeah.
Yeah, but D14s are perhaps the most neglected die in DCC.
Yeah, okay, so fix that.
No? What's more neglected than a D14?
A D24, for sure, or even a D30, but a D14 is the dwarf's shield bash, the first level dwarf's shield bash.
Mm. Yeah, yep. And D24 is an action die, and I've seen a lot of D30 tables.
D7s don't get a whole lot of action until higher levels.
I love a That's D7. True. D7's my all-time fave.
They're so sexy.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So quiz for the Spellburners podcast. What was the first DCC? And here's a clue. It's not DCC RPG. Which was the first Goodman Games Dungeon Crawl Classics product to include weird dice?
Wait, you mean the concept, or that did it actually include dice?
It had a table where you would roll a non-standard D&D die.
Got it.
I do not know the answer to that.
I certainly don't know.
Was it one of yours that has since been converted?
I'll guess the Book of Treasure Maps.
Oh, Into the Wilds.
So the 3.5 era?
Oh, God, yeah. It was, must have been like 35, 36 maybe? I don't know. I'm embarrassed not to know the number. But, But it was the, you know, when you open to the Rosloff dedication page, that was it was that cover.
Oh, it's 28.
Nice. There you go.
Well, yeah. Okay then.
Well.
And what number was Tower of the Black Pearl?
Ugh, I don't know.
Actually, I have a totally unrelated question for you. The Well of the Worm.
Yes, ma'am.
Was it that freaking disturbing before Daniel Bishop converted it?
I confess that I haven't read the Daniel Bishop conversion. So like is the mother worm like spitting stuff out at you and stuff? Is that the
problem? Oh, yeah. It's pretty gross.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm probably guilty as charged. But I bet Daniel Bishop made it even better.
Well, see, this is where I'm going to veer away from your declaration of art makes the whole thing.
I'm going to stand by that till the day I die.
These descriptions, I mean, the read aloud text, I read it. I stared at it for a minute. I'm like, what in the hell?
I will say,
holy crap.
I dug in that interview in the reprint, how you talked about, I think it's in there, Harley, how you talked about the just kind of getting into old art, right? Just like you were talking about those minis and stuff and going back to you're imagining the potential of your 13-year-old brain, imagining what was in the stuff you couldn't get to, right? But also just like sitting back with the old pulp art for inspiration and stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's almost weirdly channeled back through the writing back into the new art, right? Like it's almost a line from, I don't know, what's the old art that you were really enjoying, just as a question of, you know, what kind of stuff do you enjoy?
Just like, I'm going to mispronounce it, but like on the mispronunciation episode, so it's the French magazine Metal Hurlant, or who the hell knows?
Oh, come on. Yeah, Metal Hurlant. Okay, it looks like Jeff, Metal yeah. Hurlant.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Right? You know, but just like flipping through those, like the Mabius stuff.
Yeah.
You know, old dragons, you know, it's all about like what was Dungeons and Dragons before it became Dungeons and Dragons, and they pulled some random high schooler off the street and they're like, illustrate what a dragon looks like to you, or a warrior, and they're like, well, I don't know, so I'm gonna draw some cool thing, and they spend more time on the scabbard than like that weird like belt loop wrap around the scabbard that goes down half a dozen times, you know, like all that stuff is just amazing. We don't see it anymore because we don't see it in other stuff necessarily, because you know it's just like DC, like D&D, it's self-referential, and you guys know all this, but you know, and so the more that we can detach ourselves from what we think it ought to be to, you know, what we think it could be, you know, then the better our work is. And so, you know, it's just that all that old art, you know, I'm a sucker for any black and white, like ink wash, you know, that came out of, you know, between 1974 and 1986, it just like sings to my soul.
So ultimately you're inspired by the art, and you write wonderful stories that allow us as judges to tell them and have the players work to create their own.
Well, if that's on my tombstone, I will die a happy man, Judge Jen.
Well, yes. Thank you for all that you've given us, Harley.
It's been my privilege, my absolute privilege. Like, yeah, this opportunity comes around once in a lifetime, and just to be in the right place was awesome.
Yeah, it's Sailors is a ton of fun. So I kind of hope people were spoiled anyway, but I know you could go back and play the whole thing and still enjoy it actually. Because it would actually be, in fact, it might be strangely at least as much fun, but anyway, thanks for being with us, Harley. It's been a terrific opportunity to dive deep. Is there anything else you want to talk about or cover? Any super good question we didn't ask you?
No. But who knows what the Gen Con tournament's going to look like this year? Who knows if there's going to be there's not going to be a Gen Con. But Terry Olson and his crew of hard-hitting desperado writers are crafting Return to the Starless Sea for this upcoming tournament. And yay! It's going to be so awesome.
Yes.
So awesome to see what they write and what they create. And that's cool, right? Like that's the real next chapter. Like divorce Harley from this nonsense whatsoever. Let the next generation of authors create something cool and new.
Yeah, it's adorable that you're calling Olson the next generation.
The dude looks like he's 25. You guys say I'm 29, but he looks it.
That's
look
awesome.
For Return to the Starless Sea, you know, by, you know, Terry Olson et al. And it'll be It'll be absolutely awesome.
This fall, if I recall.
Nice.
His band of brigands.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's well.
Thank you.
So, to wrap it up, let's We're going to have to give it a rating of, is it a, no, we're not going to do that today. Sorry. that was kind of the old, that was the Joe Ben Jeffrey and Jim thing, but
every now and then it's not a bad thing, but
yeah,
we've been here a while. We can go. Exactly.
I wanted
to give it like a 3 out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
3 out of 10 tentacles. How many tentacles did the sailors get?
You know, we could have really gone hyperbole on this if we were okay. So, I did want to invite readers and also my co-hosts, all three of you, to listeners, to nominate another adventure for us to do a deep dive with, like, you know, Frozen in Time, or maybe Intrigue at the Court of Chaos, or
Hole in the Sky
would be a likely one. Maybe they shouldn't all be funnels. I don't know. They can also be third party things. So if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to hear more like this, and you think we could get somebody in a headlock long enough to get them on the show, then, you know, email or actually, even if they're not, we can still enjoy it and go through the adventure. So send us your suggestions and tell us why you think it's awesome, or more awesome than the other guy, you know, this person's other stuff or the other stuff that's out there, and make a case for it, and we'll entertain that. Well, thanks guys, it's been a good show. Harley, thanks for being here. I think you are the most guested Spellburn guest. So, and that hopefully we're going to have,
with that.
Yeah, hopefully we have another one coming up reasonably soon, with some DC 100 stuff. That would be pretty neat. So, I'm going to just say, thanks everybody for listening. You can email us at theband@spellburn.com. Leave us some reviews. We would love to get some bumpers. Even Harrison, if you're still listening, we loved yours the first time. Go ahead, you know, send us some more. And hit us on Twitter, Discord, MeWe, et cetera. And that's it. So from everybody here, keep on the starless sea and game on.
You've been listening to Spellburn. Copyright 2017. Our theme song has been graciously provided by Glitter Wizard. Learn more at glitterwizard.bandcamp.com.
We're approaching DCC number 100, and we're also approaching Spellburn 100. What better way to celebrate an anniversary than reflect? What the fuck?
Jesus Christ, Julian! Get your shit together!
God bless, dude!
Serious grammar. Okay, here we go.